They call it the reboot still.
They still call it the reboot too, yeah.
But I think they're doing
that's
it on a
bullshit.
Yeah. Well,
I don't care if they make the same boot, but man, that's named after
Ryan's it's on pick. I don't know if you recall, was yours on the Barry last?
Yeah.
They're doing it on True Balance, I believe. So maybe that's the difference. I don't know.
Oh, no. Wait, I'm sorry. Ours was on the True Balance, but the tanker was on the Barry.
Okay. No, it's the same damn thing.
Yeah, but I don't, like I said, I don't care if it's the same. They just should pick a different name because
it's his father's name, right?
That's deceased a little dirty. Father's name, man.
Well, maybe it's an homage. I mean, who knows? You can look at it both ways, I guess.
I think we'll take it that way.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Welcome to the Full Grain Podcast. I'm Phil Callis. Say hi to everybody, Nick Horween.
Hey, everybody.
Today, we've got a special guest. We got Sam Parker from the formerly from Context Clothing.
Whoa. Yes. Hi.
Thanks for being here, man. We're going to talk. I want to talk about boot porn with you. So let's get into it. I was just going through your Instagram account, which I know. Do you know what the last post was that is the end of Context, at least?
Which Instagram are you going through? Context?
Context, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Ryan did all that. I have nothing to do with that.
There's a really beautiful looking shirt on there, and I was wondering if that's what stopped you guys. But maybe we'll start right there. What happened to Context? Is that something that's gone forever, and then we all will shed tears?
15 years, you know. That's a long time in independent retail. There's only a couple people who made it longer than that. We had a great run. We had a great time. We did a bunch of awesome stuff and met a bunch of awesome people like Nick and with Nick. And that was it. Pandemic came. It had already been sort of tailing off, you know. And then the pandemic came, and at right at that same time, our good buddy Brian Bartles moved back to Madison from New York, and he was in the restaurant bar game in New York, and we were like, let's do something. So we did.
So tell me about that. I'm unaware of the new restaurant and everything.
Well, you guys did the restaurant stuff before Context, right?
Yeah, Ryan and I and Brian all worked together at a place in Madison here, a brew pub in Madison here. That's how we met. They called me Uncle Dad Boss because I'm older than them. And so I was kind of like part fun drunk uncle, part dad. And I had to be their boss for a while too. And now we're business partners and it's awesome. We've got three places. We kind of went back to our roots. Nick might know this, but when we did Context, neither Ryan nor I had any experience in retail, never even worked in a retail store. We were just kind of had some things we were interested in. That was at the very beginning of salvage denim sort of craze. And we got into that in a hurry and we thought it made a lot of sense in Madison. Despite our lawyer, our accountant, and everybody else telling us it was a horrible idea, we did it anyway. And then we had 15 years, so it was great.
That's awesome. What was that like? Because I remember seeing brands, like denim specifically brands, that you guys would get before. I hadn't seen it anywhere else. I mean, I guess maybe Blue and Green in New York was the other place, but I didn't really know. Yeah,
they opened like 2 years after we did, I think.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken. We started with Nudie. This is a great story. Actually, I'm glad you asked it. We didn't have anything to sell. We knew that we wanted to make a store. We kind of had an idea what the store should be, but we were total unknowns. We didn't know anybody in the business. We had no connections of any kind. And we somehow tracked down the name and number of the person who was repping Nudie Jeans in North America. And at that time they had like six stores and four of them were in Canada. And it was a girl named Tammy Wong. She was awesome. And we were like, we don't know anything about how to do this, but we really love Nudie Jeans and we're opening a store in Madison. I actually think if it would have been in LA or New York, she would have been like, get out of here. But I think because it was sort of in a unexpected location, I think that helped us. And that helped us actually a lot for sure further down the line, especially in fashion publications, especially in Japan. I mean, we got a lot of very funny questions about lifestyle in Wisconsin.
I bet. They probably certain times they love that they come in Wisconsin style. I can see a whole 10-page spread in like Clutch magazine about that.
Yeah, exactly. And do you walk down to the lake and ice fish for lunch, you know, stuff like that. And we were like, sure. Yeah,
today we do that.
So no, it was good. We like I said, we had a blast. We learned a lot. It was I wouldn't say it was like a wild ride, but there was definitely a few years that were pretty crazy. We grew really fast. For like 3.5-4 years at the very beginning, and that was pretty nutty. And that was when, right around the time we probably first met you, Nick. So, and then once we landed Nudie, we were like, all right, if we can get Nudie to sell us jeans, we'll make this store. And Tammy called us back and said, yeah, we'll sell you a couple hundred pair of jeans. Cool. And we were like, sweet, let's do it. And we called the guy we were trying to rent the store from and signed the lease, and off we went. It was awesome.
What does crazy look like when you say things blew up and started to get crazy? What did that look like, and where did it come from, you think? Because the internet was a little different, you know.
Yeah, I remember that was 2005. So internet retail was very different then. If you guys may or may not know this, you probably do. Shop Bop started as a little retail store in Madison just called Bop. It was a women's clothing store. And then they opened like 3 years before we did. And they got on the internet like right away. And I think the story goes, I don't know how accurate it is, but the story goes that they landed Juicy. Remember the brand Juicy? Women's
yes,
brand?
Yes, of course, yeah.
And they...
Big fans.
They got on...
love the sweatpants.
You got some Juicy on right now. Yeah, no, yeah, they, right. They... And then somehow they got Juicy to... Like they introduced it... Once they got on the internet, they introduced it in Brazil, and like somehow the Brazilian market just went completely bananas for Juicy, and that was what sort of started Shop Bop's ascension. And so when we opened Context, we kind of had a three-part plan. We wanted to make a really cool store that would be cool no matter where it was located, not just cool for Madison. And then we wanted to make a robust enough internet presence that would allow us to make that store be what we wanted it to be, even if the Madison market couldn't support it. Remember, Madison's, you know, 250,000 people. It's not that many people. And it's so we did that. And when you ask how it was crazy, it was like, all right, so who's going to make the website? Do you know how to do that? And no. And then my wife, Betsy, was like, well, I could probably put something together for you, just like something simple. And she did. So the first Context website was one that Betsy made. And then we, I don't know, a few months later, we had this high school kid come walking into the store named Aaron Davis. And we were chatting with him a little bit. He's like, I do websites. I can make a website for you if you want me to. And we were like, sure. We'll give you a pair of jeans and you make us a website. And that's kind of how it went. And then he ended up being he did all of our website stuff and all of our IT stuff.
Were you just looking for something different than doing the hospitality side of things when you started there? You were just looking for a change and going into retail, or were seeing the raw denim stuff and you're like, this is awesome. I think there's an opportunity here, or some of both.
Both.
Yeah.
Both. The place that we worked, I was the bar manager and Brian and Ryan were bartenders there. Ryan was the bartender there. And the above me, in the management scheme, there was no room to move and nobody was leaving. I was like, man, I don't want to work for somebody else anymore. If I'm going to keep doing anything, I'm going to do something that's mine. And I'm sure you guys, being entrepreneurs too, know this. You go through life and occasionally you meet a lot of people and you have all different sort of levels of friendship with people, but occasionally you meet somebody like, I could go into business with that person. And that's how it was with Ryan and me. And so we had a million different ideas for stuff to get into doing, the two of us, and they were all in the bar restaurant field. And then the space on King Street in downtown Madison became available, and it wasn't built out for a restaurant or bar. And we both were kind of clothes horses at the time, you know, like I was raised by a guy who definitely had a lot of style and taught me about that and taught me like buy the good one and buy it once. And when you have it, take care of it, you know, so it lasts a long time. And Ryan kind of had the same thing. So that led us to retail, even though we had no background in it at all.
I mean, you guys absolutely killed it.
I would
die to have a store like that.
I think we benefited a lot from what we didn't know. You know what I mean?
Like, no, what do you mean by that?
I think that it became apparent to us really quickly. We didn't really fit in all the way when we would go to trade shows and stuff. It wasn't our style. And I don't mean the clothes. I don't mean the actual clothing when I say style. I just mean like the way of interacting with people and the nature of sort of the wholesale side of that business. It's still cool. And we're going to do it how we want to do it, where we want to do it. And we'll see what happens. We did it on Shoestring. We got a little loan, paid it off really fast. And because we grew so fast at the beginning, that all worked out pretty good.
How were people finding out about the store? Do you recall?
Ryan likes to say that, you know, we sort of made Nudie the Gene of Madison. And the way we did it was the first step locally here was we knew everybody in the bar, all the bartenders in town. So we made them all buy jeans. And then they were all wearing jeans at work. They're all wearing Nudies. And Nudies are easy to spot. You know, they're especially at that time, they're distinctive. There wasn't a lot of jeans that looked like that. And we would tell them the story and teach them about Raw and how all that stuff works, and word just spread that way. And then the other thing we did, do you guys remember Super Future? Does that still exist?
You know, I don't know. I know I remember it. I have no idea. I'm sure. Let me look.
Look it up.
So online fashion forum started as a travel forum, I think, and then got really sort of overrun with people from all over the world into sort of really niche fashion stuff and a lot. And it was a forum. So there's just tons of back and forth. People just love to talk.
It looks way different than I remember, but yeah, it's still there.
Okay, cool. That's cool. I'm glad it's still around. That's great. So we both became users on Super Future, right when we first opened, but we didn't start talking about our store or, selling things at all. We just became sort of known users who could occasionally contribute worthwhile information. Down the line, after a while, like just sort of let it slip a little bit that we had a store and that we could sell stuff. And then that really helped us at the beginning. That really helped our outside of Madison and our e-retail presence for sure.
So that was 2005, or that was a little later?
Well, we opened in 2005. So that was probably more like the end of 6, beginning of 7.
So I had a similar experience, yeah, where I was a little bit after that, and I was on like style forum and like asking Andy about clothes, just sort of
on style forum a lot,
just sort of like lurking a lot and answering questions, and then people were just like, who's this guy that knows
exactly
all this stuff? And it's like, well, you know, just this guy, you know, just like,
yeah, because you know the bullshit meter of the average online fashion forum user is pretty sensitive, maybe not accurate, but pretty sensitive. And so if you just get on there and start hawking your wares right away, you can forget it. And we wanted to become like known, established contributors before we started, you know, hoping that we could leverage that into selling stuff to people. And it worked out.
Very smart. Yeah. I want to go to the boot porn, because I think this is probably roughly the same time. It's my understanding that Alden came knocking on your door.
I don't know. Nick, did you ever know a guy named Steve Grigsby?
No, I didn't.
He was the Midwest Alden rep. He was probably almost 70. And we were like, we were playing punk rock in the store and drinking tequila and, you know, and a lot of youngsters in the store, obviously. And he just came walking in one day, really well-dressed, older guy, you know, silver hair, looking good. And he was like, I work for a shoe company. And we'd had a few, by that time, we'd had a few salesmen come in and cold call us because word had started to get around a little bit, you know. And I knew Alden because my dad's got a bunch of Aldens. And he came in and introduced himself. And then he said that he was the Midwest rep for Alden. And I was like, I was trying not to act as excited as I felt, you know, because I was like, man, Alden's knocking on our door. Awesome. And so we chatted with him a little bit. And, you know, he did the standard move, showed us their regular catalog goods. And we were like, okay, let's, you know, we'll be in touch. This is awesome. We definitely want to bring something in. We'll figure something out. And then he went on his way, and we stayed in touch. And it only took Brian and I a week or so to be like, none of this catalog shit makes sense in this store. The only way it makes any sense is that it's Alden. What are we going to do about that? And we were like, maybe we can get him to make us something, just make us something for us. And I was like, we'll see about that. Maybe we can. And at that time, there were a couple stores, I think, around that had done that Alden made exclusives for, but I don't know if I would call them collabs because one of them's Alden and Carmel, Alden of Carmel. You guys familiar with that store?
And they were like Leather Soul Hawaii back then.
Leather Soul Hawaii, right. Mm-hmm. And so those places are all like basically Alden stores.
AKA you know? My boot porn websites at the time.
Yeah. So we kind of, as we talked with Steve, he talked with us about those places, and then he introduced me over email to the guy that at least used to run Alden of Carmel. His name's Adam Knott, and I chatted with him a little while about the things that they did, and that sort of made it clear that we should be able to work something out like that with Alden, and then that's how we got started. And the Roy boot was the first, the original one that we made, named after Ryan's dad. And, you know, remember, I mean, I don't think I'm getting too inside baseball here, but it's not like we're not making a brand new design. You're just putting it together, a different combination of elements that they haven't done before, but all stuff they already do. So we figured that can't be that hard. And, you know, they were really, I thought, given who we, like, what we were and how, you know, where we were in the market, I thought they were pretty cooperative, especially in terms of minimums. Like, they didn't make us buy too many of those first couple of batches. And then we had to buy a lot more after that. So, and then we made a few other ones. We made a couple of different versions of the Tanker. We made two or three different versions of the Roy.
How many of those Roy boots, the initial, the, just the brown Chrome XL with that plantation crepe sole, like the, how many of those do you think you sold?
I got to guess. I don't know. A couple of thousand, like pretty good number.
That's a lot. Of one style. That's awesome. And you were, and we talked about this a little bit before when we talked earlier, and I was like, you started talking about it, and I was like, no, don't tell, just explain to me once later. You guys did the pre-sale thing, and maybe I hadn't been looking, but I hadn't noticed that model because you were taking like a deposit, when the boots came in, then you're like, you owe us the other half or whatever, and then we'll send you the boots. So you had the customer and some of the money locked up before you even got inventory in, which is a very smart way to do it.
That obviously didn't happen with the first couple of batches, but when word got out and it got all over all the websites that people are talking about boots and nerding out. And then also combine that with the fact that we were kind of known users on some of those sites already. So people felt like they could trust us. And that's the biggest thing I felt like that's the biggest thing that made us successful. We had good eye for stuff. There's lots of people have good eyes for stuff. We were able to see some things maybe coming, you know. Remember, that was before the sort of workwear in resurgence in menswear at that time, and we kind of saw that coming, and it made a lot of sense here, you know. That was the thing about the denim and the boots and all that made a lot of sense in Wisconsin. It was like, this is perfect for the Wisconsin guy, because you can be like, this is fashion. And we always preferred to use the word style over fashion, because fashion felt so temporary. Style felt more timeless, like it lasted a long time. But like, this is the right kind of style for the guy that lives here, you know, because it's winter half the year. And, you know, it's not a lot of, like, you weren't seeing guys walking around in Prada in Wisconsin, you know what I mean? Like, that it made sense here. And so that we were right about that. But I really think the thing that made it, that made us, was that Ryan and I were on the floor of the store every day. Ryan and I answered phone calls. Ryan and I answered the emails. And so people really did trust us, and rightfully so. And so I think that that made it a lot easier for a bunch of people to give us $300 in advance for a pair of boots that might not show up for a year.
Yeah.
And you know, you got to be really clear about how ETAs and all that stuff is undeterminable, unpredictable. But people were still pretty cool about it. You always have the occasional person who
definitely
can't handle it. But that's, you know, dealing with Alden, I listened to a couple of episodes over the weekend here, and I heard, I don't remember on which one it was. Maybe it was even the last one. You guys were talking about, maybe it was with the guy with Stride.
Stridewise, Nick.
Yeah. Where you guys were talking about the difference between the Alden customer and the boot customer.
And it's changed, man. Because in your time, that customer of today's like boot nerd was the Roy Boot customer. But the world has opened up with the internet that now there's this rabbit hole to jump into. So something like the Roy Boot, like I still think it's, I have one and I love it. And I would buy it again.
I think there's got to be someone else making it now.
They are. Alden Madison, I think, has. They call it the Roy Boot still.
They still call it the Roy Boot too. Yeah,
but I think doing
that's
it on a
bullshit.
Yeah. Well,
maybe. I don't care if they make the same boot, but man, that's named after.
Well,
Ryan's
it's on head. I don't know if you recall. Was yours on the Barry last?
Yeah.
They're doing it on True Balance, I believe. So maybe that's the difference. I don't know.
Oh no, no. Wait, I'm sorry. Ours was on the True Balance, but the Tanker was on the Barry.
Okay. No, it's the same damn thing.
Yeah, but I don't, like I said, I don't care if it's the same. They just should pick a different name, because
it's his father's name, right?
That's deceased a little dirty. Father's name, man.
Well, maybe it's an homage. I mean, who knows? You can look at it both ways, I guess.
I think we'll take it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyways, there was this rabbit hole to go down, you know, even since you've closed, like since the pandemic. You know, the world has opened up with different boot makers, and the options have become very vast, where in 2005, 2010, 2015, even, it was kind of limited to what you could get. So,
I mean, we realized, I don't remember what year it was. Ryan would be more accurate with the timing, but there was definitely a point where we were like, we went from being a denim store to being a boot store, and we still had plenty of denim and all kinds of other awesome stuff. But like, it was a combination of Alden, Thorogood, Trickers, Oak Street. We did like four different collabs with Russell Moxon, which are my favorites.
All Wisconsin brand. You had Allen Edmonds. There's such like a Wisconsin thing about shoes that I think a lot of people don't fully appreciate.
I think that's definitely true. And especially if you mix in that whole Allen Edmonds thing, there's a lot of amazing footwear being made here. And, you know, I was reminded when I was listening to that one episode about the Alden customer and how, like, I don't remember, Nick, you might have said it. Some stitch is like 13 degrees off, and then the guy goes fucking bananas. And that is a large portion of the Alden customer. And so we were sort of in the position of like, we're trying to sell Aldens. And then I don't know how familiar you are with Russell, but every stitch is way more than 13 degrees off on a pair of Russells. That's what's awesome about them. And trying to find the dude that fits in the meeting of the Venn diagram of those two customers, that was our guy right there. And there were plenty of them. There were plenty of guys who, you know, weren't that worried about things being perfect and uniform. But if you're going to sell a brand like Alden, and if you're, especially if you're going to sell Shell, you're going to get a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
And we got plenty of them.
And the only luckily,
well, luckily a lot of them, most of the time, the boots that we pre-sold, because we pre-sold the Tanker too, and that was a lot more expensive than the Roy, you know. The huge majority of the boots we got were good enough for that Alden dude, you know.
So. The only time I was ever at the Russell Moccasin factory was with you and Ryan. We drove up that one time.
It's the coolest.
It is super cool. Yes. And yeah, I should have, as you're talking about them, I should have, they're like the perfect example of what I was trying to talk about in that episode, where it's so, if you want something like that, you have to embrace sort of the stitches that aren't all in a perfect straight line, because that's just the nature of that. You know, it's that triple vamp construction, which people should just look it up, because you just need pictures of it. But it's crazy. It doesn't, it's such a silly way to make shoes. But it's awesome. I mean, it's there's a reason, there's a reason to do it, but there's a reason that people don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, I think I don't know. I don't know who else Russell did a few of those like special makeups for other than you guys. I mean, I know.
Yeah, we did.
We worked on them for a long time.
We did one called the Back 40. We did one. We did a bunch of our own version of the Judy boot. If you remember what that one is from them, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. And then we did a couple of really limited runs, like 12 pair of, I can't remember the name of it, but it's the one where there's actually no additional sole on the bottom. It's like, you know, I mean, you know this, Nick, it's true moccasin style construction. All of them are, but then they would put an outsole on most of them. And we did this one that didn't have any outsole. And the idea behind it was it allowed you to move around in the forest much more quietly when you're hunting or tracking. Yeah.
They're Wisconsin also Ninja. Super comfortable. I have a pair of like something like that.
So comfortable.
Yeah.
And like, but again, I think Nick, I think that the guy that buys a lot of the Japanese brands that we also sold a ton of and like is familiar with and likes the whole concept of wabi-sabi loves Russell.
Yep.
And then you try to explain the beauty of the imperfections to that quintessential Alden guy, and that does not compute to that dude. I think I heard you guys saying you can spend $900 on a pair of boots. They think it should be perfectly uniform. And what we always said was, these aren't made by machines. Like, that's what's good about them.
Yeah. I mean, if you put them through a regular machine process, there's a chance they wouldn't even look as, they would look worse because the materials that you're using are so non-uniform. It's counterintuitive that you need to be, the hand labor makes it more consistent, even though you're seeing the inconsistencies that are a result from the hand making.
And but also just having something that's handmade, I think is just like, I mean, unless it's poorly handmade, which Russell's certainly are not, that's the best way to do it. So,
Sam, I gotta ask you.
Yeah,
backtracking to the Roy boot, I love it so much. So thank you for that. I gotta ask you: were you in the room making the decision about all the components in that boot? Yeah. Well, how did you come up with the crepe sole? Because I don't see that on a lot of pairs, and I like it, but I think I see reasons to not choose it. I'm wondering how you guys landed on crepe sole.
Well, let me tell you. A reason not to choose it. When you also sell Thorogood and Russell and some of those boots, you're bound to get a few guys who buy the Roy boot and then want to treat it and use it the same way they're using a boot with a big giant lug sole on it, and then calling and saying, sold, didn't really hold up. I hiked the whole Appalachian Trail and my Roy boot soles are trash. And it's like, well, yeah, they're, that's not what those are for. How do we come up with it? Well, I think part of it was, honestly, one part was our store had a terrazzo floor and we were on the floor of the store, you know, on the floor selling all day, all the time. And so we were thinking, part of it was selfish. Like, I want something that's comfortable when I'm standing on this terrazzo floor all day. We also really liked the way that it looked underneath that brown chrome XL. We just liked that, the way that the brown chrome looked right next to that plantation crepe. And honestly, I've got three pairs. I think Ryan does too. And we each had one of them resold with a commando just so that we had a Roy boot that we could, that could stand up to. And mostly for me, I don't, I really like, I did it mostly to have one I could wear in the rain, because that crepe sole gets
slick,
squashy, like squishy, squashy in the rain. I didn't like that.
So, I had a pair of those, of not the Roy boots. I actually don't have a pair of Roy boots. I have a pair of black Chrome XL Roy boots.
It's like we did them in black. Yeah. We did them in chamois too. Remember that?
I do. In the, is it the dark earth, I think? Or earth, like that, yeah. But I have, so I have, my Roy boots are Roy shoes. So it's the same thing, but it's a shoe. It's a, and, I wore them to a, meatpacking facility that has a tannery too.
Oh man.
And it was fine. But then I was walking through the tannery, their tannery part of it at the end of it, just to see sort of how they do things at scale. Cause the scale is crazy. And I walked through something that was, you know, had a low pH. And I walked back up into their office and I was leaving black footprints, like the crepes were just dissolving as I was walking around their office.
Oh man.
Cause it's a natural rubber, you know, it's just like, so it's soft. Well, that's what makes it comfortable, is it sort of squashy and changes. And, but yeah, I mean, if you walk through like a puddle of gasoline, like they're going to start to break down immediately.
Yeah. And if you're a guy who drags his feet a lot, scuffs his feet when he walks, you're going to burn through them in a heartbeat.
Yep.
And that's just the nature. So we learned pretty quick after the first batch or two that we had to make it clear, both on the website and when we were talking to people, this sole is not like, this sole is meant for comfort. And if you're looking for a boot that you're going to use hard and in conditions where you might be harder on the sole, we have some other options, but you might want to think about those other options.
So. Yeah. I think, I mean, to expand on that, I remember, or I think that you guys were the first people that I remember posting up pictures of stuff that was like really well worn into. Like
we did a bunch of cool projects with that.
And yep. The denim especially, and then you did some jackets with shot, and it was like it was interesting and fun, and everyone liked to see them when they were new, but when they were worn in, people were just like, oh man, like how do I make my boots look exactly like your boots specifically? That one, there's like a collection of photos where I was like, what, tell me exactly what you did to make your boots look like that.
I wore them a lot. I brushed them a lot because my dad always taught me you if you have a good pair of leather shoes or boots, you brush them regularly. And he always said it wasn't so as much about the leather. It's definitely good for the leather, but he was always like, you got to get that grit out of that welt, because as you're walking around all the time, if there's grit in that welt, it's like sandpaper just working away in there. And that's how the creases in the leather down where the right at the welt, if you got a bunch of grit right there and you're not getting that out of there and you're walking around all the time, that's how you burn a hole in that leather. And once there's a hole in the leather, there's a hole in the leather. So that's the end of that. So I brushed them all the time. I think that pair that everybody loved those posts of, I had resold once by Alden and through their whole, I think they discontinued that whole refurbishing program they did.
They still do it. The recrafting program. They still do it? Yeah. They still do
it, yeah. Okay, good. So I don't know what they did to them, but I just wore them a lot, brushed them a lot. I never put a thing on them. I never put nothing, no mineral, nothing. I didn't do anything to them except brush them. And if they got really dirty, I'd clean them with a little saddle soap. And that happened some. But I really think it was just time and use and care. So like, it's like a math equation kind of, right? But you can't, you got to have all parts of those in there, because again, like the guy who hiked the Appalachian Trail, he had the use.
Is that a real guy, by the way?
Well, that was a real thing. I mean, he claimed that. God. I don't know what he actually did. I wasn't with him, but
1,200 miles in a pair of Roy boots. Like,
give me ridiculous. A break. I mean, come on.
I mean, admirable. I mean, I guess, but
I think it's admirable to hike the trail, but it's, I think you got to make a smarter decision on your footwear and that.
Yeah. Hopefully he's wearing suspenders and wool breeches and had a handlebar mustache and probably was eating beans out of a can every night. A
couple of vests. Yeah. He had a couple of vests on.
Yeah.
No, I never did anything. People used to ask that all the time. How do I get mine to look like yours? And I was like, use them and take care of them. That's it.
Simple.
So those are your boots. Do you remember taking the photos for that? Was it like a pro photography thing, or was it just like, we're going to throw up these boots and take some quick shots?
Well, Ryan did all the photography. So we had a photographer early on when we first put up the website, and actually we had like a series of two or three guys, and every one of them had kind of at a certain point went haywire for whatever reason. They were just like unreliable or something. So Ryan was like, fuck it, I'm just going to learn how to take the pictures myself. And he did. And he does all the photography for the restaurants now and all the social media for the restaurants.
You guys have a thing about first swing home runs, I think, is what it seems like.
I think that's true. And I think that's also partially due to what I said earlier about like not knowing what you don't know. Like, if we would have listened to the people that were trying to give us advice at the beginning, we probably never even would have made the store, and we probably certainly wouldn't have been like, we're going to pick the most niche shit in a tiny market and try to make that work. But we didn't know. We were confident, and I think that, you know, we were so into what we were doing that rubbed off on,
I think that's it,
in the store. Like, we were into it, dude. It wasn't bullshit. Like, we weren't like, let's see what product can we pick to sell the most of. That wasn't what we were doing. We were just into it. And so then people would come in, and I know for a fact that people sensed that, like they felt that from us, and it was contagious.
I got to tell you, my favorite story involves your Roy boot. When I would tell friends of mine, they'd ask, you know, hey, Phil, we're all done with college now. What kind of work are you doing? Oh, I'm working for this leather tannery. And they're like, oh, that's weird. First of all, that's
quite weird.
Story over. But then they're like, well, what do they make? Oh, the leather's used in the footballs and a lot of shoes. And a lot of my guy friends would say, well, I like shoes. Show me some shoes. And my go-to was that set of photos of the Roy boot. And I think I got you some sales. At least, I can think of at least three people that I'd show that picture, including myself. Just like, oh my God, that's so awesome looking. And I don't know. I still love those. And I even know one of the other people we had on the show, he has a very, very popular blog and community, Ben from Stitchdown. I think he said that those same sets of photos are what made him fall in love too. So, on behalf of all of us, thank you again.
Well, thanks for getting us those sales. Come to Madison. I'll buy you a burger at the bar.
Well, nice. Well, actually, I wanted to get into that too, because I love Wisconsin. I've my family's up there, not my immediate family, but aunts and uncles and stuff. So we'll go up. I have a place in Minocqua that we like to go visit and hang on the lake and do all that stuff. It's great. And one of my favorite things about Wisconsin is the, and I always forget the name. What's the name of the type of restaurant that's like a shack on a lake and there's nothing? It's Supper Club. Sorry. It's a Supper Club. Is that what you're doing? Well, please tell me you're doing a Supper Club.
One of our restaurants is a Supper Club. It's called, I don't have to plug it, but it's called the Turnkey Supper Club. And it's not on a lake, though. Supper clubs don't have to be on the lake. Some good ones are on lakes. particularly in the Dells. There's a couple of really well-known ones in Wisconsin Dells that are right, that look over lakes. But yeah, one of ours is a supper club. That's our newest one.
What is that called? I'm going.
It's called the Turnkey Supper Club.
All right. And that, all your places are in Madison?
Yeah. Yeah. Our first one, the one we made right after we closed on Context, is called the Settle Down Tavern. And that's actually in the same building that Context was in, but in the space sort of behind the space where Context was. And then we opened, remember that was in the pandemic. So we opened Settle Down in May of 2005. Good planning. And we still had Context kind of shuttered.
In 2005 or 2020?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, 2020. I'm thinking of something. Yeah, sorry. So anyway, 2020. So right in the, right in the pandemic, it was couldn't have been the worst timing. But then we still had the Context space shuttered. And after when we were about a year in with Settle Down, we were like, let's do something in the old Context space. So we built a little cocktail, this weird psychedelic astrological cocktail lounge there called Ounce by Ounce. And that's really cool. And it's still operating. And then we, a year and a half ago or so, we opened up the Supper Club on East Wash.
That's awesome, man.
Nice.
Well, you were saying Context was a labor of love and it wasn't bullshit. It was like all the stuff you're into.
Yeah.
Did you fall out of love? Like why can't I have my Context?
Yeah, I ask myself that same question when I'm buying at retail now.
it sounds like you just were smart and just said, like, 15 years and the market is now completely different than it was when we started. There's so much. And I remember talking to you guys too, and you were having a hard time getting product delivered at times. Mm. And it just sounds like you were just smart and you're like, I think it's time.
I think we were, but I think we could have been smarter. And what I mean by that is we probably would have shut it down even earlier.
Mm.
And not because of the pandemic, because you can't be mad for not predicting a global pandemic, but the business had plateaued. It was clear. And internet retail had completely changed. If you remember, like, I think we were one of the last people we knew in the business to like get on to Shopify. Everyone was like, why aren't you using Shopify? And we were like, what are you talking about? And then when we did it, we were like, holy shit, we should have done this a long time ago. But I just think there was, when we started, there wasn't that many places like ours. And now, and I think it's a good thing, there seems like there's a Context in most medium-sized cities. That's awesome. I think that's great. But part of what, remember, we're in a pretty small market here. And so we knew that in order to be able to afford to have the store be as cool as we wanted it to be, we had to rely on more than just the Madison market, using the internet to do that. Well, then as menswear evolved and more dudes like us made more and more stores like Context in more and more places, then that's fewer people that feel the need to order online. Right.
Right.
And then I think also the nature of where menswear was going, like those last, like from 2017 or so on, made it, I don't know. I feel like we got in at the right time for what we were into, right? Like the whole workwear and, revival of American made and raw denim, of course. And so then that section of the market and Context kind of grew together, and then the market changes because it always does. And so then it was like, hey, we can be done with that now. And then our buddy Brian was like, I'm moving back to Madison. Let's make a bar. And we were like, hell yeah, let's do it.
What do you think the market changed towards?
Oh, I just remember so many people coming in. I mean, maybe I'm overstating it, but I remember just trying to not to make a bad face when people would come in and be like, do you have any athleisure? And we'd be like, athleisure? No. I don't know. It just became, I think it shifted away from as much of that sort of trad, you know, workwear kind of stuff that we were into. And that's not, that's totally how all aspects of the fashion market go, right? They don't just stay same forever. It's constantly shifting. So I still think that Made in America means a lot for a lot of people. Although, yeah, I think that means a lot to a lot of people. And I think raw denim is always going to have its, you know, its sort of core group. I think that a lot of the guys who got into it, you know, at when we were doing it, now have probably moved on to whatever they think the next thing is. But there's always guys that are going to stick with that. And then the same with the boots and the leather goods. I mean, we had our own, you know, we had our own leather guy in the house who bought a bunch of stuff from Nick and made a bunch of good stuff. I think that stuff will always have a
the infamous Oliver Sell.
It's Oliver. He's still doing back
plug,
now.
We should plug. I know.
I've got some. I've got some stuff. He made me some stuff. I've got a couple walls. I got to put them up.
Yeah. He
makes great stuff. It's beautiful.
It's cool.
Attention. Yeah. His attention to that, to detail and how he does stuff is precise, and he doesn't want to cut any corners ever, but you know, there's a limit to how much stuff he could make, obviously, the way he was doing it. Sort of like Russell. Like, we'd be like, we made this. This is the third batch of these back 40s we want you to make for us, to Russell. And a lot of people want them. Can you make us 80 pair? And they'd be like, 80? How about 20? And we'd be like, okay, well, we'll take what we can get, but it'd be better. Same with Oliver.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah,
it's good stuff. Yeah, it's there's something to be said about that notion. It's like, well, instead of like being like, well, 80 pairs. I mean, I got to figure out how to deliver these 80 pairs because I don't want to turn this order down. Instead of being like, that's not what we do.
Well, you like,
make it 20 because that's what we do.
There's three people making shoes.
Yeah, but that's how you maintain your core customer, and that's how you keep your product the way it's supposed to be. Is you're stubborn. You're not going looking at the balance sheet every year. Like, all right, we got to grow 10% next year. Yeah. So we're going to add two people that can make the shoes no matter if they're any good or not. And we're going to be able to fill those 80 pair orders. And you can get away with that for like a year or two. And then people realize like something's different and you're, for lack of a better term, like you kind of sold out because you're just trying to make money instead, it's not really for the love of the product anymore. And I think that at some point, every business that is growing is faced with that decision. It's like, are we gonna stick to our guns and like, are we gonna do what we started off doing that we're good at, that we love doing, or are we gonna try to make some money? And I think there's a way to do both, but it's a tightrope for sure.
We saw many brands over the years go through exactly that, and then guess what? The huge majority of them, as soon as they started, the ones that made that mistake that you're describing, they weren't around very long because people saw that what they were used to getting from them was different now, for sure. So,
and you could spot the brands that I think have done it, or not all of them, but you can spot them by how long their lead times are, because people want the stuff, but they're not willing to really change the product fundamentally. So a place like Alden, and like we're talking about Viberg, and then there are a lot of the smaller makers too that have decided to stay small. And it's like, if you want this kind of product, you're going to have to wait 26 months. And if you don't want to, then just go get something else. It's just kind of it's just the way that it is. And you endear yourself and alienate yourself at the same time.
Imagine what happened with Horween, with you guys, when all the supply chain shit fell apart. How long it must have been super hard just to get product for you, right? And then you're, if you can't get product, then how do you fulfill all your customers? I mean, that
was, yeah, it was a nightmare. We keep track of inventory in kind of like a weird way, but we keep track of inventory based on how many pieces, like from a hide standpoint, how many hides we have, we own or have contracted versus how much we have sold.
Sure.
And you know, almost always it's, we own more than we've sold because that's just, it's the only way we can, with those long processing times, we have to keep the pipeline full. Otherwise you get these gigantic lags. And there was a time specifically on Chrome Excel, which was, you know, a product that we've made forever that we know how to make. And we were so far behind and it was just like, I don't know, like it's going to, like if we increase production by, you know, X percent, it's going to be, you know, 60 weeks until we catch up. That was a tough, I mean, there were some other tanneries that I won't name at the moment who stepped in and tried to start to order offer what they were calling a replacement just because they were taking advantage of the fact that we just couldn't make the stuff because of what you're talking about.
Jumping into that white space in the market, right?
Yeah. You know, and that's what the market is. There's no bad blood there. I mean, it's like, everyone's in business for themselves. You got to do.
Yeah, and also
their customers.
I don't know. I can't speak for you, obviously, but I feel like if I were you, I wouldn't be sweating anybody trying to act like they know how to make Chrome Excel.
No, I mean it's one of those things where it's what we just talked about. Like you can sort of convince people for like maybe a couple seasons that it's the same, and then you start to get like the actual data, and like you can see how the product looks different over time, and people are like, yeah, it's not really the same. So it just takes time, but it is frustrating in the moment. But you just gotta.
I mean, plus Orwean, you know, just the Orwean name is so powerful in that market that I'm not trying to blow sunshine up your ass or anything.
I'll take it,
and it's for sure. If you can say this is made out of Orwean leather, that means something to the people that know for sure.
Hey, let me freak you out. Check this out. Watch this.
Recording in progress.
Guess who forgot to hit record? I'm recording it in other places, but I should have.
Recording stopped.
Should have recorded here too. Idiot.
Well, we can do it again if we need to.
No. That's why I don't know if you see the other monitor here with like
I can see
I'm tracking everything, so I got it in multiple places because I
You guys should keep talking if you want to keep talking. I have to take this call, unfortunately. But
maybe we can quickly just end with some favorites here because I would love to know what you guys are doing in Wisconsin to chill out. What do you enjoy doing that's not work related?
Oh man, I don't do much that's not work related, honestly. I've got two kids. One of them lives abroad now. She's 21. So I don't have to deal with her as much, but my son is in high school and plays a bunch of sports. So I'm going to a lot of sports. Tennis season is just starting now. So that's coming up. My wife and I are avid cooks. So we do a lot. We spend a lot of time cooking. I don't go out to dinner very much, which is funny given that I have restaurants, but I don't know, man, I'm sort of at that sort of, it's kind of an awesome middle age stage where I don't feel as compelled to try to do tons of cool shit all the time. Like I got the cool shit that I like, but I got bigger fish to fry, I guess, than that stuff. So I'm a home espresso making enthusiast. So I probably spend more time nerding out on that shit than I do on boots or jeans now. So I'm really into that.
You mentioned earlier that you would play punk music in the shop. Is that your main? That's your go-to still?
No, I mean, I like punk. I like any kind of loud, aggressive, abrasive music.
Oh my God, you're so speaking my language, and you perfectly teed it up for me to hit my own first swing home run. I got to talk about Fallujah again
every
favorites until they show up on the show. But
what is it? I don't know what that
Fallujah is. Like a technical death metal band that I love. It's a little bit of an inside joke on the show here, but give me some hard aggressive music because that's what I like.
I mean, that's definitely what I'm into. I listen to a lot of stoner. I've been finding these obscure European stoner bands that have the most hilarious names, like Hashtronaut and Beelzebong and shit like that.
Nice. I'm going to drop off because I'm sorry, but you guys keep going.
Nick, man, it's so good to see you.
Yeah, too. I'll give you a call tomorrow and we'll catch up a little more.
That was good, man.
All right, man. Good to see you.
Thanks, Nick. Have a good night. All right, Sam, I'll give you one that my band introduced me to last night called Heilung, Heilung.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of like, I can't believe I hadn't heard of this because they have more than a 500,000 monthly listeners, apparently. But it's like ritual, ancient, like German tribal music. I mean, just look at this. I don't know if you can see the...
Yeah.
It's like if Braveheart was a band or something like that. Might be up your alley, but it was like kind of psychedelic, like very like a ritualistic kind of like chant, but in a brutal, like metal-y kind of way. It's good.
Yeah, I think that for me, I definitely, for a guy my age, I definitely I'm not a Luddite. Like I'm an adopter. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not one of these guys who's like, I don't use Spotify. And, you know, I think there's a huge value in streaming services for music because I can find new stuff in a, you know, much more easy way. But I also have a really close friend who owns a record store here.
Yeah.
A record store in Madison called Strictly Discs. And so he's always yelling at me for anytime he catches wind that I'm listening on Spotify or some kind of streamer instead of buying physical music. And I get it. But I do find myself, I have a harder time with sort of, I don't know the way to describe it, but like the mainstream metal, the current mainstream metal. I don't want to call out any band names, but just I'll bleep it out.
I want to know what you're talking about.
I don't even like, this probably isn't even that current or mainstream anymore, but like a band like Godsmack or something like that.
That's not current.
Oh shit, sorry.
No, I get you. So like that's like new metal, like Korn or something, right? Like early 2000s metal, right?
No, I can't do that. I don't mind. I'm not one of these guys that's like, if it's not 30 years old, it's no good. Like, that's not what I think. I just think there's a style that has, there's one style that has proliferated that I can't get with.
Mm.
And then there's a number of other styles that have sort of, that are not hot right now, that are the ones that I like the most. And then they'll come back, you know, sooner or later they'll come back. Like I just want, like somebody's got to make like a hard rock band that utilizes regularly the two guitar harmonized solo, like the Scorpions did. Like, it's just the best.
Yeah, man.
But no one's doing that now, you know? So
I think there's those older bands are still, some of them are still playing, like,
yeah, but I don't.
Iron Maiden does three guitars, and they're still doing stuff.
So that's the other problem with. I like all that older stuff, and a lot of those bands are still touring. But I've made the mistake to go see a couple of my favorites, and
it's not the same.
So part of what makes the kind of music that I like the most good. Is like the desperation and the danger and the sort of like giving no fucks part of it, you know? And when you if you've seen a band from when they were playing little teeny clubs and you've seen them blow up and they're one of your favorites, and then you suddenly go see them when they're in their 50s and they're rich and famous, I don't know. It doesn't hit the same at all. And I can think of a couple of different examples where I have to actively try to scrub that most recent memory from my head so that I can, so that it isn't in front of all those old memories, you know?
That's a tough one. I wonder if it can relate it to context. So I'm thinking of Metallica in that example.
Oh, exactly. That's a perfect example, because the first four Metallica albums are some of the best heavy music ever made.
So it's like Metallica's first two albums were, you know, raw denim, salvaged denim, and then, you know, they came out with the Roy boot. And it's like suddenly, like, now they're the guys that do like denim and Roy boots, and like that's what they're known for. So they kind of have to, like, the Black album is like, all right, I need more Black album, right?
That was the beginning of the end,
right? And like, I don't know, I wonder if it's that, it's like the market tells you what they want, but like you've identified this whole time, or it's like, I don't want to really follow like a course, right? You're just picking out things that you think are fun and exciting, and sometimes people don't want that.
And I think also, like, I think my wife would say it's probably one of my flaws, but I think I just am too that's not the right way to put it. I'm too dead set on doing what I want to do and how I want to do it. And I'm not necessarily willing to it's making compromises isn't the right way to put it, because you must make compromises in life. Everybody has to, but more like, at least for the big things in my life that I do, man, I've got a way I'm going to do them, and that's how I'm going to do them. And if it works out, then that makes it even better, especially if it comes to like career and how you make your money, you know?
Yeah.
But never judged. Like I was saying earlier, like, man, Context had a great run. I don't judge it either based on that we had to pull the plug. You know what I mean? Like, I don't look at that as a fail, but I also don't judge it as like, you know, the middle of like how fast we grew and how sort of, I don't know what the right way to, either notoriety or money or whatever, all the stuff that came along with that. That was awesome. But I also don't judge it based on that. The way I judge it is I got to go to work every day, like fired up and like excited to do whatever it was I was doing at work. And I get to do that now too at the restaurants, because I love, you know, I love serving people and I love making sure everyone's having a good time and it's comfortable. So, it's funny. I think my wife would say, maybe you ought to, you know, worry a little bit more about how much money you're making every day, or maybe you ought to worry a little bit more about how much risk you're taking. And I'm like, it's just not how I do it. So anyway,
I respect that. I actually think I needed to hear that personally.
So I think that if you
can just living in the moment a little bit better, you know,
but you probably do, like, you love what you do.
Yeah, I do. But, you know, sometimes it's, as we've had, maybe you can relate to this, as we've had a reasonable amount of success, I'm noticing that there's demand. So I have a child now and like family and stuff. So I'm trying to delegate and like multiply myself by hiring other people to do some things for me. And what I'm noticing ends up happening is I just have meetings all day, and that's sort of not what I love, right? So I'm actually reverting. I'm like, all right, maybe we're just going to keep the business a little smaller, you know? And
yeah, but I would also tell you this, and this is obviously a personality thing totally, and because I feel this way, you may not. But the huge majority of people that we had working for us at Context and that we have working for us at the restaurants are much younger than me. And we too, we got three places and, you know, almost 100 employees and tons of managers and all that stuff. So there's a lot of meetings, like you said. And when you go into a day where you know you got meeting after meeting after meeting, part of you can be like, Jesus Christ, I just want to get behind the bar and pour some beers, you know, and talk to people. But I've definitely learned that interacting with young people, and I mean staff, I don't mean guests, I mean staff, in those meetings and on the floor during service and in all parts of the business, it keeps me young is a really sort of corny way to put it, but it's more like, a lot of times I'm in a position where people are asking my advice or they need my help with something or something like that. And I love doing that. And I realize that however much I'm helping them, they're helping me. Like that interaction helps me, maybe even more than it helps them. 'Cause who knows how good my advice is? Who knows? But, just having that as part of your life. How old is your child, if you don't mind me asking?
She's 3.
Oh shit. You're in the shit. Okay. I gotcha. So
that's why podcasts have to start real late. You gotta sometimes it takes her, you know, 2 hours to go to bed. It's crazy.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's good. It's fine. Everything's fine.
Our first never wanted to go to bed. And then our second, our son was like, I'm going to bed. We didn't even have to say anything. He would just waddle his little butt up the stairs and go to bed. It's funny how different they are, but, yeah, I really think that you were talking about that whole process of hiring people to do stuff instead of you doing all of it. And at least for me, I have a certain amount of, I'm not a perfectionist, but I like things done a certain way.
Hmm.
Particularly when it's involved in something that I care a lot about, like context or like the restaurants. And so it took me a while to get to the point where, like, to feel more comfortable handing stuff off. And the way that I did it, I'm not trying to give you advice or anything.
But I need
the way
it, man. I would love it. Thank you.
The way I did it was I interviewed this person multiple times, and then I hired them, and then I decided that they were a good candidate to take on more responsibility and maybe move into a management kind of a role or something. Well, I didn't make those decisions because they're an idiot, and I didn't make those decisions because they're incompetent. The opposite is true. So if I'm going to hire people who are smart and competent, I'd be crazy not to like take advantage of that by not only making sure they're heard, all that they are involved in the process of like how to get better and how to make the business, continue to improve, but also just to take some of those reins. Like I feel like I think it was like an epiphany kind of for me where I was like, wait a second, what does it say about me? If I'm not willing, what does it say about my ability to judge a candidate, like an employee, if I'm not willing to hand the reins over to them?
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, like I said, I'm not trying to
give you advice. I get you.
But that's the thing. I think that's the thing that a lot of small business owners go through for sure. You start something small, like Ryan and I started Context. It was just me and Ryan. And we had to hire a few people on. And as we went through that process, it was hard, especially because, you know, I spoke earlier about like trust, like you're building trust with a customer base, right? Well, that is profound and important. And not just because they buy stuff from you, but because, like, think about driving. What is driving a car? It's trust, right? What you're doing is you're trusting everyone else on the road that they're going to stop when the light's red and that they're going to go when the light's green. And you can't control whether they actually do it or not. You can only control what your car does. So you're coming to a four-way intersection with a street light and your light's green and you decide to go through that just to keep driving like you're supposed to because the light's green. You're trusting the other direction. That dude in the semi is going to stop at that red light. Like, it's trust. So trust is like not something to be taken lightly. And so if you've spent months and years building up trust with, building up trust with a group of people who rely on you, who come in and say things like, I don't know anything about how to look cool. Can you guys help me? Like, I don't know how to dress. I don't know anything about style. You guys, this place seems cool. Can you help me? Like, they're putting themselves out there in a very vulnerable way. They're trusting you, right? So you can't then expect it to be easy to say, hey, Billy, 21-year-old I just hired, take over.
Right.
All that trust is now I'm leaving it up to you, Billy. That's hard. Yep. But
yeah, you're right. I still answer the phone calls. I don't do everything. I can't. And honestly, like, that's the funny thing too, is like everybody there is better than me at making all the stuff, that's what I like, is I just like the material. I like looking at the leathers.
You like talking about it too.
I love talking about it.
So I bet that when people call, like, that means a lot. Like, we look, like I said earlier, the passion and how much you're into it, that is contagious to people. Mm-hmm. So some guy sees your product online and isn't sure and calls and gets you.
They're like, oh, what? Yeah, you're the guy from the videos? Like, yeah.
But even if they don't know that, like, even if they don't realize who they're talking to, you know, like, we didn't say this is Sam. Like, I didn't answer the phone at Context and say, hey, Context, this is Sam. I just answered the phone. But just the way you talk about it, any subject that you're really into, that, like, most people, not 100%, but most people feel that. And it's a real feeling. And it means something. And so, I don't know. I think it's great that you still answer the phone. You should totally still do that all the time.
I love it. You're right. I do love it.
Yeah. It's great because sometimes you deal with that. You're going to deal with assholes no matter what line of work you're in, no matter where you are in the world. There's just a certain percentage of people who are just kind of jerks. And so you just have to chalk that stuff up to the cost of doing business. But most of the people you talk to, it's like, yeah, man, that was fun. I had a good time, like helping you figure out what size Roy boot made sense for you. I'm explaining to you what to expect. And it feels this way now. Or like, We made this boot called the 113 boot with Thorogood. Do you remember those? Did you ever see those?
I didn't know.
These were made with what were those? It wasn't waxed flesh. It was, horse? I can't remember. It might've been horse butt. I can't remember. But man, that was a heavy ass leather. Yeah. So it's called the Thorogood Context 113 boot. That's one of my favorite boots.
Orwin's Plainsman. It's like a full grain Chrome XL.
Wow. Yeah. Man, people would put those on and they would be like, I don't know. It feels kind of, you've dealt with this a ton too, I'm sure. It feels kind of stiff. And like the process of, this sounds might sound kind of weird, but like you got someone who's really unsure, who's not experienced in that world. And they came in because they wanted to see what was going on. They saw something they liked. They talked with you a little bit. And they were like, whoa, I want to try that. And then they put it on. You could tell that they were unsure. There was a lot of like uncertainty there. And they didn't want to make a mistake. You know what I mean? Like they don't want to be like, if I spend $450 on this boot and then I can't wear it because it's not comfortable or it doesn't fit me right or whatever. And so going through that process of like, having them put it on, feeling the shoe while it's on their foot, explaining to them what they're feeling and why they're feeling it and how that feeling is going to change. And then talking to them about care and use and then seeing them get comfortable with it, comfortable enough, especially for, you know, there's people you deal with them. We had plenty of them. People just come in and spend a few $1,000 without even thinking about it. They weren't even thinking about it. But that's different than the guy that I'm talking about, the guy who's like not that sure. And you can like teach him and educate him and then like get him to get comfortable enough to try this thing that he really wants to try. And then it works out and he'll come back to you every time he wants something like that.
Yep.
Because he trusts you. It goes back to that whole trust thing.
So, yeah, you're totally right. Yeah. It's really, you can be very disarming too. When you just tell somebody like, hey, this isn't for everybody, or here's why this thing isn't good. Like if you just are straight with people, it's actually funny. Like the more I tell people not to buy something, the more they actually buy it. Isn't that exactly. weird?
So there's two kinds. We used to say there's like a couple different kinds of people. There's just the dude that comes in that wants you to tell him what to buy. And that's a pretty significant portion of the market. People who just don't want to think very hard about what they wear, what they buy. They want someone else to tell them. And they figure that it's worth paying a premium to do that. So they'll come to a store that sells $900 boots and $350 jeans, and they're willing to pay that money, A, because they have it, but B, because they just want someone to tell them what's cool. And if you tell them, you know, those guys will buy it. But then there's the other guy who, like, isn't sure, like I was saying before. And if you're just really, like, straight and honest with them, mm-hmm. and like, I don't know, maybe it's from having all that experience in the restaurant, in the bar business, you know, before that. So dealing with hundreds of people every day and like really learning how to read people and learning how to understand people and learning like the right way to take care of people. Like you can tell if a guy is, he saw something in a magazine or he saw something on your Instagram and he's like, that's so cool. Like you say, he saw that Roy Boot post. That is the coolest. I want one of those. And then he comes in and you can tell he shouldn't buy it. Like you can just tell by the way he's reacting when he puts it on or by the rest of his style, you know, by what else he's wearing or how he, you know, you talk to him a little bit. How do you plan to use it? What are you going to do? You can tell it's not the right thing.
Right.
And you're totally right. If you say, yeah, man.
I don't think that's going to do it for you.
I don't think that you talked yourself into this thing. You think it looks cool and it does, but that doesn't mean it's right for you. There's other things in here that are definitely right for you. Let's figure that out.
Here's the funny example I have in mind is if let's say you have two boots and they're the same. One is beautiful Chromexol. One of it is beautiful Cordovan. And I usually tell people, I'm like, do you know what Cordovan is? And if they say no, I say, this is special leather. I can explain it to you. I think it's nice. It's way more expensive and it's not for everybody. So like unless you're just like a huge fan of leather, that's really like the only reason I suggest paying this huge premium.
Right.
And it's almost like that's sincere too when I explain that, but it's almost like they feel like a challenge. Like, oh, like I can appreciate. And that wasn't the motivation for saying it. It's like really like, I personally wear a non-Cordovan thing and I can choose anything I want. And I find other Horween leathers to be beautiful. So it's like not necessarily worth it. It's weird. It's like you can't, it's almost like if you tell them to get something, then they wouldn't. But if you tell them not to, then they do. I don't know. But I usually do what you do is like, what's the use case? Like, oh, how are you wearing this thing? And like, what are you going to do with it?
And you can see how they react. It's the same with any, like, it's not just boots, it's jeans too, especially. Like, you can see how they react when they put something on. And you can see them looking at themselves. And I feel like with a pretty high degree of accuracy, I can tell by the way they react when they see themselves and how it feels. That dude, he'll buy it. But he's going to go home and every time he pulls it on, he's going to be like, I don't want to wear these. I'll wear something else. And then guess what? He just spent $300 on a pair of jeans or something or whatever it is. And they're just going to sit in his closet. And every time he sees them, he's going to think about that. And he's going to think about where he bought them. And so I feel like if you say to somebody, yeah, man, I don't know if this is the right thing for you. I think you should look at some other stuff that we have. He's going to, maybe he won't even remember that too, because he's going to end up getting, but what he will remember is that he ends up getting stuff that he likes and that he wants to wear every time he looks at it.
I have a concern that people are conditioned to not trust a salesperson. You know,
I think that's totally true.
Yeah.
And that's what, but again, that all goes back to your passion and how into it you are. And yeah, I mean, it's an old sales tactic the takeaway move. That's a thing in sales, right? Which is kind of what you're saying. Like, oh, this one's not for you. You don't
it's
want
so
this.
So funny. That's like one. Not even trying to do that, but yeah, I guess that's.
Oh, I know you're not. I wasn't saying you were trying to do it. I'm saying it in sales. Like that is a known tactic. And so, but that's a known tactic by the type of salesperson that is not trusted in the way that you were just describing. If you're just talking to people honestly and you're straight up with them, most of them sense that. And
I think these smaller companies like Context was, and there's plenty of them that you alluded to earlier. Anybody listening that goes to a place like that, just trust the guy, just trust the guy or gal, whoever is serving you. Like they want you to come back. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think most people can tell if they're dealing with just a shyster salesman, as opposed to if they're just talking to someone who's like, and you know, some people be like, whoa, you're really into this. And I'm like, yeah. Ryan sometimes would say, I remember him saying to me a couple times, will you stop talking about the two different weights of yarn and the low tension loom that the Pure Blue Japans were made, you know, that fabric was made on, and why they, and how they have to buy that loom and then hot rod it in order to get it to weave at a lower tension. Will you stop doing that? People are just like, their eyes are glazing over. And I would realize sometimes you get too data heavy. But
you can tell if the person's into it. Some people are totally into that. Yeah.
Some people are totally into it. And that's another important part of the skill set is being able to recognize that. Yeah. But yeah. Anyway.
Hey man. It's
miss those things. Yeah.
Well, you know, I didn't want to, maybe I'll cut this part out, but you know, just put it out there. If you consider doing it again, I honestly think there's room for many more contexts or businesses like that. I know you said it's oversaturated, but I think there's something there.
I think there is. I think that that's not a return to something like that isn't entirely out of the range of possibilities for me. But I got all kinds of other stuff I also want to do. So
well, that makes I was also thinking about brandy old fashions and coming up to.
Yeah, come up, man. Just connect with me.
The Suffer Club. Sure.
Let me know when you're coming.
That'd be awesome. Man, I would love to. Last time it was in Madison, I had such. It's, you guys got a beautiful town too. It's great. I got to go and take my family up.
Yeah, come this summer, and then you know, just wait. Which way would you be coming?
From the southeast, so we just take 90-94 or 90 up.
Yeah, so come through Madison on your way up to Minocqua.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Just hit me up for sure. Maybe we get drag Nick's ass up here too, and we can have a good time.